Okay, hi again. This is Bob Brundage, and today is the 17th of April, 2004. And today we're having the great pleasure of talking to Jerry Reed from Florida. And as you all know, Jerry is currently the Executive Secretary of Caller Lab and happens to be here in Albuquerque for a dance last night and another one tonight. He and his wife, Del, are enjoying our beautiful Albuquerque weather. overcast today, but be that. So, Jerry, we have a lot to talk about.
Okay.
We want to talk about Caller Lab, and we want to talk about arts.
Okay.
But for the time being, why don't we start, as I usually do, by talking about your background. So why don't you let us know where you were born and brought up. And
okay. Let's see. I was born in November of 42 in Kearney, Nebraska, just about in the middle of the state. We lived in a small little town along the Union Pacific Railroad. I joined the Navy when I was about 20 years old and retired from the Navy after 21 years, and then went to work for Lockheed in California. Oh. Actually, I hired on in Austin, Texas, with Lockheed Missiles and Space. And from there, actually moved to California, lived about three years, and then moved to Florida to continue working with Lockheed, and retired from Lockheed in, must have been December of 1999.
Okay.
I had already been selected as the Assistant Executive Director of Caller Lab, and George White passed away in June of 99, and the plan was that I would take over as executive director at the 2000 Caller Lab convention, but unfortunately George passed away in June of 1999, so I became the executive director at that time, and of course was still working full-time with Lockheed. So Georgie and Dar Johnson and the rest of the home office staff in Rochester really pulled the weight through that year until December when I retired, and then we opened an office in Florida.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, what about some of your earlier experiences? Did you come from a musical family?
No, not really. I did a little bit of singing in high school. I was a member of the Boys Glee Club and the Mixed Chorus, but no great aspirations there. Mostly I was involved with sports, so... But it was a small little town and a small little school, so we only had, there were like 33 people in my graduating class, so
uh-huh.
It was a small Nebraska town, but no big musical background at all.
Okay. So what was your introduction to square dancing?
Actually, I was stationed in the Navy in the Philippines in the early 60s, and got involved with square dancing at that time, learned to square dance, and left the Philippines in, must have been about 1964. And actually, because of my job and everything, got dropped out of square dancing until about the mid-1970s. And then got interested in taking a class again and got involved and became intrigued with the calling end of it. And then went back to the Philippines in 76, and there was a small square dance club there, and got interested and actually started calling in 1978.
I see. Well, that was my next question, your introduction to calling. So.
Right.
All right.
Well, I was, like I say, I was in the Philippines. It's, as all of the, or most of the overseas areas are, isolated areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the caller that was there learned to call while he was there, so he wasn't a whole lot of help to me. But there was a Filipino gentleman, Chuck Carlos, who had been calling about 20 years, and I got together with him, and he was really able to help me a lot as far as, you know, appreciating the music and staying on time with the music and the beat of the music and pitch and key and all of that kind of stuff.
Okay. Then who were some of your mentors along the way outside of this Mr. Carlos?
Well, actually, I wrote to Jim Mayo while I was in the process of trying to learn how to call, and I explained my situation and asked Jim for any guidance that he might be able to give me. And he wrote back a very informative letter and gave me some pointers of getting started, and I still have that letter framed on my wall in my office because it meant so much to me. And Jim to this day still uses that story as in his caller schools about this fellow that wrote to him from the Philippines asking, you know, here I'm in the Philippines, how do I learn to call? And it took Jim a long time to figure out how to answer this this letter. So that was, I also got a hold of Bill Peters' book, The Other Side of the Mic. I actually had a copy of Jay King's book, but it was so complicated that I didn't understand. I got through about the first chapter, and that was all I was able to make through that.
I did the same thing, right?
Yeah.
How about caller schools? Did you ever get that?
Well, yeah. Well, while I was in the Philippines, I applied to Sets in Order for a scholarship through Bob Osgood, and he did. He gave me a scholarship. So when I returned to the States in 1981, I connected, went to a school with Jim Mayo and Bill Peters in Tifton, Georgia. And it was a week-long school and very informative, very informative. Right. Had a very good time there. Learned a lot.
Right. One of the questions I've been asking is, what do you find appealing about calling?
Many, many things. When I first started, I was intrigued. I liked mathematics, and I equated calling to mathematics. Uh-huh. You start with zero, and you do some adds and subtracts and some multiplies and divides, and then you come back to zero, and everybody's back home with original partners. So that's really what got me intrigued in the beginning. But over the years, I have I've really come to appreciate the teaching of new dancers and the experience that that bringing dancing to new folks brings. It's really a rewarding experience, and to see the changes in people as they come to class and then as they begin to learn to dance. It's really a rewarding experience.
Yeah. Well, with your busy schedule, do you have any time for teaching now?
Yes. In fact, we've got a class scheduled to start the first weekend of May when we get back, which is about 2 or 3 weeks from now.
Right.
Well, and when we're really looking forward to that.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, excuse me. How about other callers' associations?
Let's see, I've moved around a lot, having been in the Navy. So I've moved about 5 or 6 times, and so I've been involved with several of the Callers Association. Initially, I was involved with the Callers Association of the Philippines.
Uh-huh.
And then back to Virginia, got involved with the Tidewater area in the Norfolk area,
okay.
Callers Association. And also the Capital Area Callers Association in Texas, Austin, Texas, when I moved there. And then back to Florida, and I was involved with the Central Florida Callers Association.
Right.
And, of course, a member of the Florida Callers Association, of course, call that also.
Yeah. Well, of course, they have a big festival there in Florida.
Yeah, they do. There's the state festival is the one that I'm involved with. There's the Sunshine Festival, which is a paid staff, and that's not really part of the Florida Callers Association activities, but the state convention each year is sponsored by the three organizations: the Dancers Association, the Florida Callers Association, and then the Round Dancers also.
Okay, well that's great. How about national conventions?
I was involved with the sounding. I was called vice chairman of something or other, Sound, I believe it was, worked with John and Linda Saunders on the national convention that was in Orlando several years ago.
All right.
Other than that, only involved as far as calling at the nationals and, of course, now with Caller Lab we have a vendor booth, and we're part of the showcase of ideas.
Right.
We attend all of the national conventions now.
Right. Have you made any recordings at all, Jerry?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to get hooked up with Dick Weibel and Buckskin and Rawhide Records.
Oh, yeah.
And I recorded about three songs, I guess, so far. I did Country Roads, John Denver song, which is very popular. I think Dick has told me that they've had to repress it a couple of times. Santo Domingo I've done, and then I did a Patsy Cline song as my very first one, and just recently completed a sing-along, the John Denver Country Roads sing-along.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's not been released yet. I'm hoping maybe Dick is waiting to release it for the national convention.
I see. Right. Well, that's great. Well, I know your connection with your service to Colorado, you're responsible for writing quite a bit. Outside of that, have you done any composing?
Before I got into the executive director position at Colorado, I did quite a bit of writing as far as articles for direction, articles in the national convention, articles in the national magazine, American Square Dancing, and also the local Florida publication, Balance Swing. I've written quite a few articles
right.
for that also.
Right, that's quite a popular magazine.
Right.
Right.
I'm quite proud of my involvement with the standard applications documents that were produced by Colorado.
Right.
And also the choreographic guidelines, which is it's kind of a training manual, not kind of a training manual, it is a training manual for newer callers and people who are involved with training callers.
Right.
And we tried to write it in such a way that it wasn't overly technical so that the new caller could understand what was being written and to help the new callers get started, like I say, callers who are helping callers
right.
get started. And
well, that's great. Well, with your vast experience and interesting life with square dancing, do you have any regrets? Is there anything you wish you'd done differently?
No, not really. I look back on all the tens of thousands of miles that I put in driving to dances back and forth. I remember when I was in Norfolk, Virginia, I called for four clubs. Two of them were on the eastern shore. So one of them was 100 miles one way, another was 75 miles one way. And I can remember back only maybe two or three times driving home from one of those dances. I said, what the heck am I doing? Driving 200 miles to call a dance.
But right.
That was only a couple times. All the rest of the time, it was, it's been a very rewarding experience.
Right. Well, I had the same type of experience. I lived in southwestern Connecticut, and then I had two clubs in Massachusetts, so it was the same thing, about 100 miles each way.
Yeah.
And traveling up there three times a week.
Yeah.
But, a little serious question before we get on to Caller Lab. Where do you think square dancing has been, and where do you think it might be going?
Well, that's really a tough question because, as we all are aware, in 2004, the talk is that square dancing is on the way down, and in many areas it is. We have gotten a lot of reports, though, of places where square dancing is in fact growing. The people in the classes are increasing. The places that are using the multi-cycle program or multi-start program, as maybe many people refer to it, are having success, and those clubs are growing. I've tried to take a look at the numbers over the years, and in Jim Mayo's book, A Wonderful History of Square Dancing,
it
talks about the loss of dancers, and it appears to me, and I don't know if I don't have any facts and figures to back this up, but it appears that the dropout rate has not changed. It really, in the days when we got 15 or 20 squares for a class, we would have 25% dropout fairly regularly, and then another 25%. And we didn't notice it as much because we started with a much bigger number.
Right.
These days, if we start with three squares and we lose half of them, it's a dramatic change, and
right.
we do notice it more. I feel that we there's a lot of work to do to bring square dancing to the non-dancers. The dynamics of the not the dynamics of the activity, but the dynamics of society have changed so much
True.
Over the last 20 or 30 years that the things that we used to do to get people into square dancing just don't work anymore. In those days, the 60s and early 70s, your experience is the same, I'm sure, where you just put up a flyer and talk to people and you open the door for your class and you got, you know, 5 or 10 squares of people
right.
that show up.
True.
But these days, the dynamics of the family have changed so much. The dynamics of social time, recreation time, computers, video games, multi-screen theaters, everything has really changed so much that in order to get our message to the non-dancers that the activity is full of social benefits and physical benefits and health benefits, to get that message to the non-dancer and then to convince them that this is an activity that they should try, that's our big challenge right now.
Right. Well, what's your opinion on a lot of folks are thinking that we've made square dancing too complicated?
I think when I got involved with square dancing, it was 1978 when I started calling. And, of course, CalloLab had been around for about 4 years at that time. There was a lot of talk about that time about all position dancing and dance by definition. And I was isolated from that for the first couple of years because I was in the Philippines and away from the main body of square dancing. So I wasn't exposed to a lot of that, but what I've read and heard and talked to other people, my understanding is that was true, that there were some callers who would revel in the fact that they could break down the floor and that they could come up with choreography that was very, very difficult and that the dancers would have trouble dancing. What I've seen over the past 5 years for sure, and perhaps even longer than that, is that CalloLab at least, and many of the members, most of the members I would hope, are moving away from that attitude that we need to make square dancing complicated and moving toward the idea that we need to make square dancing less complicated, more fun, bring smooth dancing and enjoyment to the dancers rather than the challenge.
Right. Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that contra dance people seem to be drawing good crowds and so forth. What's your thoughts along that line?
I've attended some of those, and I've noticed that the contra dancers are able to draw people who come to the dance. They might come to the dance and for the first half hour go through a series of introductions, and then when the main part of the dance begins, then they're able to dance along. There are certainly fewer figures used, and the beauty of contra dancing is that the dancers are able to move to the music, and certainly accomplished contra dancers are very able to move to the music and with the flow and the ebb of the music. I think, a less complex dance. It's also less structured than modern Western square dancing.
Very true.
Yes.
Yes, right. Well, you have a good friend up in Denver, Cal Campbell, who, along with Bob Howell and Ken, he lives here in Albuquerque, his name escapes me now,
yeah.
wrote that nice book about dancing for busy people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any hope for that type of a program? It's a, sort of like your community dance program.
It is. When the community dance program was first introduced, it was a set of about 25 moves. And the idea at the time was that program of less moves, a fewer number of moves, would be introduced and could be taught with 25 moves, could be taught in probably less than 10 lessons. That concept never did really catch on. There was a lot of effort put into it. I know Calvin Campbell put a lot of effort into trying to get it to work, as did other callers throughout the country. And it just didn't work the way that they anticipated or hoped that it would. So the emphasis on that whole program, that CDP program, the community dance program, has shifted from a program of a certain number of lessons, a certain number of moves, into more of the square dance party atmosphere, where we introduce square dancing or have square dance parties, sometimes for people who have never danced at all,
right,
and introduce them to modern Western square dancing, as well as circle dances or line dances or mixers, and just have a party of it. That seems to be the focus now of the CDP committee, which has actually changed its name now to the Committee for Community Dance.
Ah, okay.
And Dancing for Busy People is really along that lines also. It's
right.
Line dances, circle dances, mixers, and simple square dances.
Right. Triples.
Triple, yes. Oh, okay. All the line and contras, they include contras.
Right.
A master at that is Greg Anderson, of course, out of Colorado Springs, and Mike Seastrom also does a very good job.
Right. Well, I know Cal has been running, prior to the Colorado Convention, this his special thing,
mm-hmm,
on,
yes,
one-night stands and so forth.
Right.
Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, it's been a very successful program. We call it the Beginner Party Dance Leader Seminar.
Okay.
And it is run on the Saturday and Sunday prior to the Colorado Convention. And the focus of that seminar is to introduce callers and partners to the idea of running square dance parties, and again with the same focus as the Committee for Community Dance. Contras and lines and mixers and square dances, simple square dances. And that's been very successful. I think this year in Reno we had, I think Cal said, just over 50 people altogether. So it's been a very successful program.
Right. Do you foresee, as some people do, I keep reading on our traditional square dance computer program, that some people are thinking there's going to wind up to be two different programs, really, modern Western and the traditional type of thing that you're talking about.
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if that were to happen. I know there are a lot of CallLab members and other callers also who concentrate almost exclusively, and almost for all of their performances, almost exclusively are square dance parties. They
right.
don't call for a what we might call a modern Western square dance club, but they do the square dance parties.
Right.
And CallLab over the last 3 or 4 years has really come to realize the value of those callers, and we've tried to implement more of that into our convention and into our writings.
That's great.
Because we recognize the value of that of those callers and the service that they provide to the overall activity.
Right. Well, that's great. I'm really happy to hear that, because my sentiments have been that this is a coming thing for square dancing in the future, even as an introductory program.
Correct.
And I'm afraid that the square dance people, square dance club people, might be taking people away from that kind of a program. But that's the natural that's the natural progression of things, so
right.
So be it.
And it could very well be. We find that many times the people who attend the square dance parties might only attend once a year at a special event, or perhaps twice a year. And a certain percentage of those will become involved with or more interested in learning more and become involved with a with a regular square dance club.
Yes.
One of the interesting things that we discovered, the Carlab Foundation a couple of years ago ran a series of focus group surveys among non-dancers and ex-dancers. We also ran an internet survey of 1,800 participants through a professional marketing company. And the one of the interesting things from that internet survey was the people who had been involved or exposed to square dancing as an adult had a very favorable view of the activity.
Right.
So what that is interpreted as is that the people who go to those square dance parties and the parties that Calvin is providing information about, the beginner party leader seminar, come away from that experience with a very positive view of square dancing. And at some time in the future, if they are approached at a time in their life when they're looking for an activity such as square dancing, and if we can present it in the correct way or an effective way to them, that they may very well become involved with what we would call modern Western square dance clubs.
Right. Well, do you see any future for the open dance, like the contra dance people do, or anybody can drop in any time?
I think we've really talked about that, and I've really thought about that, and it appears from an economical standpoint that for such a program to be viable, and by viable I mean just in order to meet the bills that would be required, because you have, you know, hall rental. Even if the caller does not take any pay at all, you've always got hall rental, and you've got equipment to pay for, and the licensing, and all of those things that cost money. And I've tried to look at this, and of course have no facts and figures, but in order for such a program to exist viably, I would estimate that you would have to have a base of probably about 400 people who would come on some kind of a regular basis. And that regular basis, I had not expected it to be more than once a month or perhaps once every other month. And if such a program were able to be established, and just, you know, every Saturday night or every other Saturday night there's this dance, and just come and enjoy, that it appears that you would really have to have a very large base of people, because they're not all going to come at the same time.
Right.
So some will come, like I say, once every other month or perhaps once every 4 months.
Right. Well, that's interesting. It certainly warrants a lot of additional thought, because we're all interested in keeping the activity going on some basis or other.
One other point on that: I'm not really sure how the traditional groups are able to do what they do. I know that the live music is a big part many times, and that certainly is a draw. And it's my understanding, and I'm not sure if this is true, you would know more about it, but that it's mostly word of mouth that it spreads, and I've seen some flyers around. I know that these traditional dance parties are much more popular in some areas than they are in other areas.
True.
And I have heard that in Gainesville, Florida, I'm not sure how often, whether it's once a month or once every, you know, twice a week or whatever, or once every other week or something. I'm not really sure how often it is, but this particular dance leader is able to gather, you know, like 100 people or more at each event.
Right.
And it's a college town. I understand there are some college folks that do come. And mm-hmm. I don't know enough about how they're... I know they're not organized much at all, one group to the other, but I've seen some flyers, and it's really a good thing that can happen.
Right. Well, we have an active traditional group here in Albuquerque, and they meet twice a month here, and the same organization sponsors it in Santa Fe on the opposite 2 weeks of the mm-hmm. month on Friday nights. And they charge a little bit more. They charge $6 per person, and with a half hour free lesson and so mm-hmm. forth ahead of time. And they have live music all the time. And I believe the musicians very often are low paid
mm-hmm. right.
or not paid at all.
Right.
Some
right.
musicians come and just sit in
right.
And,
right.
and not expecting to be paid.
Right.
I'm not sure what the pay for the callers might be, but they turn out a big crowd twice a month here, and I assume the same up in Santa Fe. Right.
Now, is it like the same, would it be repeat people who would come back, or is it mostly new people, or...
Tape shut itself off automatically, unexpectedly, so we lost part of our conversation. But we're going to continue now and turn. We're sort of overlapping some things, but we wanted to talk with Jerry about anyway. And we'll get back and concentrate more on Caller Lab, and a little later to talk more about arts.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about the founding of Caller Lab, and I've seen quite a bit of written material, which is very comprehensive, and I think your reference will be helpful on this tape.
Okay. Actually, my knowledge of the beginnings of CallLab are pale when compared to the written word that
right.
you've gotten already from dosoto.com and other sources. But... it's my understanding that this was Bob Bosgood's brainchild.
Mm-hmm.
He recognized that we were a very fragmented very fragmented activity with callers all over the country. No cooperation. Each caller doing their own thing, and just a disjointed activity. And he recognized that there was a lot of large talent out there that had a lot to offer and could offer to other callers and to the activity. And it was his hope to bring those people together and to form an organization that could share ideas and share their resources. And he gathered a small group of people and began talking, and eventually grew into Caller Lab.
Right. Well, many of those founding people were Ed Gilmore and Bruce Johnson and Lee Helsel and a few people like
mm-hmm.
that. And then he's concentrated on the Hall of Fame people,
yes,
which
yeah,
had
yeah.
already had started to be established by that point
mm-hmm.
time. And so then as time went along, he had a unique way. It was by invitation only at
correct,
first.
Correct.
And then after a year or maybe two, each one of those members were allowed to invite one more person,
mm-hmm.
which doubled it. And then after that, it kind of expanded
right.
after that.
I think when I first became involved, of course, I learned to call in the Philippines in 78, and I came back in 81 to the States, and I was, at that time, it was still an invitation-only activity,
uh-huh.
and I believe that each member was allowed to invite three people. I think, I'm not sure exactly what the numbers were, but I know that you had to be calling at least 3 years, and you could get invited, and I was invited and did attend the my first convention was in 1985 in Philadelphia, and Hank Butler invited me, and we
drove up there and shared a room, and it was just a wonderful experience to to sit there and in the audience and see these giants of the activity that I had been reading about for years,
right.
And to actually meet the people was a great thrill.
Right. Well, I remember my first Call Lab convention. I forget when it was, but I believe John Jones might have been the chairman at the time. I made the comment. He said, "Did you ever stop and think?" He said, "With all these hundreds of callers here, that if a bomb dropped on this hotel at the moment, how long it would take for the activity to regenerate?" And he said, "About a week."
Yeah, that's true. But sometimes we kind of overestimate our own importance.
True, right.
But it was really it's really been a great experience. And one of the things about the Call Lab convention is, as everybody who has ever attended one knows, that it's not just a gathering of callers. It's a gathering of ideas. And the interest sessions that we try to provide provide a tremendous amount of training and information. Over the past 3 or 4 years, we've begun to concentrate more and more on the square dance party activity, the one-night stands. We used to call one-night stands, and now square dance parties. And just to meet people from all over the world is a very unique opportunity.
Do you feel that we spent too much time in Color Lab talking about choreography over in the past?
In the past, I think it's hard to say whether or not it was too much. I think when I first convention, I still remember at that time we were talking about the PLUS program and which calls should be on there. I remember attending sessions about the timing, trying to work out the timing, and the definitions was a big thing at that time, and what was going to be on each list. And in the early days of those days, it was important to discuss those issues and to set those standards that have now been set and have been in place for a couple of decades. At that time, we've talked before about how around that time, there were callers who thought that choreography was supposed to be difficult, and it was if a call could be danced from a particular position, that the dancers should be able to do it from that position. If they can't, they should go somewhere else. That attitude is gone, and in those days, much of the interest sessions had to do with that kind of choreography.
Right.
And how to create that complex choreography.
Right.
And in those days, I think that that was the attitude at the time. It certainly changed now, and our attitude now is different but not difficult.
Right.
And creative choreography that is not difficult, that is entertaining, and is danceable.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, that's interesting. Well, I know you've, over the years, in fact, more recently perhaps, gotten into things like the wives program, the caller's wife or spouse program.
Yes.
And and various things like that. Do you have any thoughts along that line about how these programs have developed?
Yeah, we really, I believe that the involvement of the partners' sessions and that part of the Color Lab convention program actually started before I became involved as the assistant executive director and involved more closely with the organization. But the partners now have a partners committee, and all partners are invited to join that committee. This year at the Color Lab convention, we had 6 different time slot session times for the partners. There were committee meetings, there were interest sessions, we had partner informals to give the partners a chance to just meet and talk about the things that are of concern to the partners.
Right.
So over the past 4 or 5 years, certainly, the concentration of intercessions and help that we want to provide to the partners has certainly increased. We're always looking for more help in that regard.
Well, you've also had very extensive programs on financing, accounting.
Yes.
As well as equipment.
Correct.
Maybe you can tell a little bit more some of the alternative things.
Yeah. At each convention, we do have choreography sessions. I mean, that's what we do.
Yeah.
So we'll have choreography sessions. We have advanced and challenge sessions. We have mainstream sessions, plus sessions. But we're also starting to concentrate more on other aspects of calling. We have a session this year, as we did last year, on teaching tips, so that we can gather information about how various callers teach various calls to try to provide each caller, the members, an alternative way to teach things. We've also had a very popular program on digital music, what digital music is,
right.
The equipment that's available, the software, the computers. We have also had voice sessions that concentrate on how to improve the voice or how to take care of your voice.
Well, they've been going for some time.
Very long time. Arden Hopkins has been able to attend, I think, probably about 20 conventions or something
right.
like that. We also have sessions on the beginner part of the seminars. We had sessions this year, some of the other sessions, I'm trying to think what we have. The RPM program, the recruit, promote, and maintain. We have teaching in schools or calling in schools session this year. We have calling for handicapable groups this year. We have how to prompt contra and traditional dancing, and we plan next year to expand that into two sessions. One would be an introduction to contra and traditional music, and then another session which would actually be a critique session where a caller would who wants to learn to prompt contra would actually practice and then be critiqued on the technique and how that person might be able to improve. We have sessions on multi-cycle program and of course all of our committee meetings also.
Right.
So the amount of convention time these days devoted strictly to choreography has been greatly reduced,
right.
Certainly since you know, as compared to at least 10 years ago.
Right. Well, you also do after-party things.
Yeah, we have an after-party on Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening, and that's always a good fun time to
right.
to get little tidbits to take home.
Right.
We have also, during the convention, at least a couple of dances. We have a contra-traditional dance. On Sunday afternoon, we have a community dance program. And then some type of other regular square dance during the convention also.
Right. And banquets.
Yes, we have two award banquets, the six meals. During the awards banquet, we present the milestone, if there is one, and the chairman's award, if there is one, the foundation awards, 25-year certificates to the people who've been calling for at least 25 years, and the 50-year certificates for the people who have been calling at least 50 years.
Right. I don't think I ever got one.
Oh, my.
But you didn't make. Well, let's talk a little more about arts.
Okay.
So tell me, this is the Alliance.
It's the arts is the Alliance for Round, Traditional, and Square Dance. It's an alliance of many, I should say most, of the national organizations. And I'll try to run down who those are. We have Collar Lab, and we have Rounda Lab, and Contra Lab, and the American Collars Association, and the NEC, and the USDA, United States Dancer Association, USA West, the NEC, National Executive Committee for the National Square Dance
right.
Convention.
Right.
We have the Singles, we have the campers, and we have the International Association of Gay Square Dance Clubs, and we now have the Universal Round Dance Council. So let's see, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I must have redoubled up there, because there's 11 organizations altogether.
I'm surprised the overseas dancers are not part of it.
That's an interesting point. I'm trying to think whether they're not.
Al Stevens must have been there at the caller.
Actually, Al missed this convention.
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, right now we're really concentrating on the North America area to get this started.
Right.
We have approached the Canadian Square and Round Dance Society.
Okay.
And there are other organizations who are interested in becoming affiliated. One of the things that the governing body didn't want to do was to become so large that nothing could get done.
Right.
Like I said, right now there are 11 organizations who are the governing body.
Right.
And the arts is open to membership. Individual memberships are for a donation of $50 in any one year. Individual members can become individual members, and associations for a donation of $100 can become associate members.
I see.
We've gotten several donations from several organizations. There are fundraising dances that are being held. There was one in San Diego that brought in about $500, and another one planned, I believe it's later this month or next month in Birmingham, to raise money also. And the main purpose of the alliance is to bring all of these various organizations together to come up with ideas of how to spread the word, to get more people involved in all of the dance activities, and that includes the contra traditional, the round dance activity, and of course square dancing. And when we talk about square dancing, small letter square dancing, we try to make it clear that it includes all of the related dance activities, the contra traditional, the rounds, even lines, and circle dances and mixers, and all of the related activities.
Right. How about folk dances?
That too. We try to involve, we want to try to include all of that under one umbrella. One of the concerns, I guess we could say, is that trying to find an organization that represents the folk activity has not been an easy chore, because they're not organized. Each individual does their own thing, which is great, they're not being organized as part of their appeal, because they're not overly organized. They don't have to worry about who's going to be president, who's going to be chairman.
Right.
You know, it's none of that political stuff. It's just get together and dance.
Really. Now, is arts in conflict with Color Lab Foundation?
Not really. The goals of the arts are very similar to what the Color Lab Foundation has been trying to do for the past 10 or 15, 20, as long as the foundation has been in existence. And the reason that the foundation did these things was because there was no other organization that was doing them. And we recognized, the CoLab Board of Governors recognized, that this is work that needed to be done. So the CoLab Foundation was formed and began doing that work, such as the song and dance brochure, grants and really grants to other organizations who needed grant money to help spread the word of square dancing.
Well, you put out a film too.
And yes, we got videos. They ran the focus group surveys. The foundation also did the internet survey. So we've got the couch potato TV ads, which the foundation did. if in fact arts goes forward as we hope that it will and becomes a viable organization that can in fact take on some of those things that the Collab Foundation has done in the past, it appears that what the Collab Foundation emphasis will come back to collar training and that kind of thing. We do administer a collar training and actually collar and dancer training education fund,
right.
And the Collab Foundation administers that. So that would be more of what we would do.
I follow you.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's all very interesting. I certainly wish arts a great success, and they're really relatively new.
Yes, it was just in the past 5 months was incorporated. The arts was incorporated in North Carolina. We've applied for a 501c3 IRS tax exempt, tax deductible status.
Yeah.
And one of the things, of course, that we recognized early on from the focus groups and our marketing research presented to us by Jim Hensley was that we are a very fractured activity. We had so many organizations in each kind of doing their own little thing, which many of the goals and the goals of those activities, those various organizations, was really the same, to improve square dancing. And one of Jim's goals or things that he thought we should do is to bring those organizations together. And we were able to do that through the arts. And
right.
So it's really, to see the cooperation among the organizations is really it's an amazing thing.
Right. Well, that's really interesting. And I'm very happy that we got this information down, because in addition, I'll be talking to,
Jim Masco, who's the current chairman.
Okay, I plan to interview him very shortly. So, well, Jerry, I want to thank you very much for taking the time today, this morning, to sit down with me and bring all these thoughts to bear.
Fantastic.
And you've been very articulate in a lot of points that I was happy to have recorded. So,
good. I really appreciate your efforts too, Bob, on just doing this project, because I know it's been a massive, massive project to not only do the interviews, but then to transcribe everything from those interviews. And I know that the total collection is going to be something that future dancers are going to really appreciate.
Well, I think I have somewhere around 125 interviews so far, and they're not all transcribed.
Right.
Lately, I've been transcribing each one as I go along. Mm-hmm. Originally, I had some help through the computer, through the email, the people on the TRAD list and on the callers list, and various people undertook to make the transcriptions for me. So we wound up with many different formats.
All right. Yeah, that's always a problem.
Right.
But different
be that
people
as it may.
Yeah.
So. Well, I hope you enjoy your stay here in Albuquerque. You had a nice dance last night, and I hope you'll have another good one tonight.
We're certainly looking forward to it.
Okay. Well, if I get back to Florida soon, I'll give you a jingle.
Stop in and see us for sure.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jerry.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
From the previous conversation, it's really easy to tell that Jerry Reed is very erudite, not only in his own background, but the history and goals of Collab. As we chatted after the tape was shut off, I suddenly realized that I had forgotten to make mention of one function that took place at the recently completed Collab convention up in Reno, and that is a tribute to Bob Osgood. This tribute was complete with many, many pictures, sound bites of Bob calling and others calling on his Sets in Order record label. And there was also a sort of a eulogy presented by Jim Mayo. Many of our young and newer callers probably didn't even know who Bob Osgood is or was. He was certainly responsible for the initial formation of Collab in the first place. He edited and published Sets in Order magazine, the first international square dance magazine, and was instrumental in many, many other activities. Our square dancing certainly owes a debt of gratitude to our good friend Bob Osgood.